Good evening. I'm Caitlin Boyle from Harvard Bookstore. Welcome to the Brattle Theater, and welcome to tonight's reading with Martin Amis. We're a full house tonight, and I really appreciate your patience with the crowd and the line and the cold weather. Before I turn things over to Peter Kadzis, who will introduce Mr. Amis, I'd like to share with you a few of our upcoming author events and some details about tonight's signing. On Friday night at the bookstore, we're welcoming Colm McCann. He'll be reading from his new novel, Zoli. And on Monday of next week, we'll have Susan Eaton at the store discussing her new book, The Children in Room E4. And we're also excited about Vendela Vida, who'll read from her novel, Let the Northern Lights Erase Your Name, also in the store on Tuesday the 6th. You can check our website for more events next week and the week after, and add your email address to our sign-up sheet, which is going to go around the room. You can also do that online if you'd like to get our weekly email newsletter. I'll remind you, too, that tickets for the Norman Mailer event on February 15th are now available in the store or over the phone with a credit card. Tickets are $3, and we strongly encourage you to get those quickly if you're interested, because they're going to go fast. After Mr. Amis's talk tonight, we'll have a book signing here at the front of the room. You can purchase your books first at the back table that you saw when you came in, and then get in line, and we'll have the line go directly from the book purchasing table straight up to the signing. I think that's it. Thanks for your patience. Thank you for supporting your local independent bookstore, and join me in welcoming Mr. Peter Kadzis.
Good evening. Well, you know, once again, on behalf of the Harvard Bookstore, welcome to the Brattle Theater. It is a full house. Well, you know, Cambridge has a wonderful duality. It's a city in which people think big, subversive, and sometimes even useful thoughts. But in social terms, it's very traditional. The proprieties are observed. Tonight, I am the propriety. My name, as you know, is Peter Kadzis, and as the editor of the nonconformist left-wing Boston Phoenix, I have just enough feeble stature to claim a spot on this stage as sort of a literary Ed McMahon. I'm still scruffy enough, however, so as not to dull the luster of tonight's guest, tonight's star, Martin Amis. It's a source of wonder that in this age of YouTube and MySpace and Slate and Salon, not to mention Bondage.com, that so many of you will actually fork over hard currency, post-tax dollars, if you will, to engage in that quaint 19th century custom of assembling to listen to an author read from his works. It's almost like going to church. Looking out over tonight's congregation, I'd say that while we're a step down from the Unitarians, we're at least a step above those energetic evangelicals who like to bite the heads off rattlesnakes when they worship. Tonight's text is taken from Mr. Amis's most recent novel, House of Meetings. It's a piece of virtuosity set in the gray grimness of Stalin's Russia. House of Meetings is a spiritual sibling to Mr. Amis's work of 4 or 5 years ago, which is rather enchantingly entitled Koba the Dread. Koba is a powerfully uncomfortable examination of Stalin and Stalinism that should really leave most utopian leftists with a lifetime supply of migraines. But we're here tonight to worship at the House of Meetings. Reviewing this book in last week's edition of the Phoenix, our critic James Parker said this: "Read late Amis, maniacally alert, secular in timbre, but religious in the fidelity of his observations, and stay on your toes." While all of you are busy staying on your toes, I am going to exit. I give you Martin Amis.
Hi, thank you all for coming. Are you nuts? I mean, it's a very cold night, and let me get my glasses on. As you get older, you not only get balder and bulkier and bunkier, but also blinder. Don't forget blinder. but that may be not such a bad thing. I read about a new neurosis or psychopathology the other day called dysmorphic visualization disorder, otherwise known as perceived ugly syndrome. This is where you look in the mirror and see something far worse than the reality, and that's what I hope I've got. In fact, getting older seems to me to, you find yourself auditioning for and then starring in a coarse, irresponsible, and above all, low-budget horror film, where, as usual, they're saving the worst for last. I'm going to read some things that might have upset some people here. My narrator is not it's not instantly recognizable as a force for good. But as this whole book is addressed to his stepdaughter, black American stepdaughter in Chicago. And as he says in the opening words of the book, he expects her censure. He expects her shock and disapproval at the things he's done in his life. He's 85 at this time. But he says, I will get your disapproval, but make it personal, Venus, he says to her. Don't make it the disapproval of your ethos, your peer group, your time. He's asking her to expend some historical imagination. And this is just after the war in which he fought. And you've got to remember that in 1941, in June, the biggest army ever assembled quite burst unprovoked over the border, the western border, to wage a war of extermination, of annihilation on Russia. And when the turning point of the war, the Battle of Stalingrad, when the German general surrendered, he and the Russian general looked out over Stalingrad, and there was nothing higher than your knee in the whole city. And the Russian general said, one day Berlin is going to look like that. Okay. I'll just set it up. This chapter begins with a sentence that was described as iconically macho. I like that. Really butch sentence. Which goes, my little brother came to camp in 1948. I was already there at the height of the war between the brutes and the bitches. This was in fact a civil war among the hereditary criminals in the career criminals in the camp. The bitches wanted to stop being criminals and start being trustees and start being guards, and the brutes wanted to go on being brutes. Now, his brother comes at night, and the older brother hangs back. Lev is the younger one, the older one isn't named. And comes up behind him the next day as he's sitting there, his first day in the camp. Lev's first day, he would spend most of it with the medics and the work assigners, was also the monthly day of rest. I came up behind him in the yard. He was sitting on a low stone wall where the well used to be, his knees pressed together, his shoulders sloped forward. He was cherishing his fractured spectacles and trying to believe his eyes. And what did he see? The thing that was hardest to grasp was the scale, the inordinate amount of space needed to contain it. In his line of sight were 5,000 men. 10 times that number lay to the sides, beyond, behind. When you got used to that, you had to come to terms with the evident fact that you were living in something like an army base where the conscripts had been drawn from a direly indigent madhouse or a direly indigent hospice. In your nose and mouth was the humid breath of the camp of Norlag and more distantly, the fresh cement of the brand new Arctic city, the monumental denture of Predpolozhsk. And finally, you had to absorb an assent to the ceaseless agitation, the mad dance of the stick insects, the nervous fury of the zona. His brother turns. It seems that I'd better describe him now, your step-uncle, to prepare the ground for the thunderclap that is barely a page away. There was something yokelish, indeed almost troglodytic, in the asymmetries of his face, the features thrown together inattentively as if in the dark. Even his ears seemed to belong to two completely different people. Say what you like about it, but my nose is unquestionably a nose, while Lev's was a mere protuberance. And when you looked at him side on, you thought, is that his chin or his Adam's apple? He was also, as a kid, short, meager, and sickly, a stuttering bedwetter in inch-thick glasses. All he had was his smile. In the mess of his face lived the teeth of a beautiful woman, and his rich blue eyes. The eyes of an intelligent, definitely an intelligent. I said, don't turn around, and when you do, show no pleasure in seeing your elder brother. He stood up, he walked away, then circled back into range. For a moment, I found his faintly hooded, self-caressing expression impossible to read. It seemed, in the circumstances, simply alien. After the jail and the interrogation, after the transport, many new arrivals were already mad, and I feared my brother was already mad. Guess what happened to me, he said. I said patiently, you got arrested. No, well, yes, but no, I got married. Congratulations, I said, so you finally knocked up little Ada, or was it little Olga? He didn't answer. Look at the eyes now, the eyes of an old believer. Part of his mind was away somewhere, dancing with itself. This was clearly a great coup of love he had brought off, a grand slam of love. Has it ever happened to you, Venus? The color of the day suddenly changes to shadow, and you know you're going to remember that moment for the rest of your life. Registering an impressive contraction of the heart, I said, not Zoya. He nodded, Zoya. You little, and there's an unprintable word, and I wheeled away from him into the yard. After a time, as I staggered along, buckling and straightening, shaking my head, scratching my hair, I felt him settle into step beside me. I'm sorry, he said, please don't hate me. I turned, and with an older brother's grooved cruelty, spinning it out for at least three syllables, I said, you? We sucked up breath and looked out into the sector, and saw what? In the space of 3 minutes, we saw a bitch sprinting flat out after a brute with a bloody mattock in his hand, a pig methodically clubbing a fascist to the ground, a work-shy snake slicing off the remaining fingers of his left hand, a team of locusts twirling an old shit-eater into the compost heap, and finally a leech who, with his teeth sticking out from his gums at right angles, scurvy, was nonetheless making a serious attempt to eat his shoe. I whispered it. Lev and Zoya got married. If I can survive that, then I'll never die. No, brother, he said, you'll never die. Sighing heroically, I added in a clear voice, and you can survive this, and now you'll have to. Zoya. When a man conclusively exalts one woman, and one woman only, above all others, you can be pretty sure you are dealing with a misogynist. It frees him up for thinking the rest is shit. So what am I? You have consumed your share of Russian novels. Every time a new character appears, there is a chapter break, and you're suddenly reading about his great-grandparents. This, too, is a digression, and its import is sexual. So do yourself a favor and go and get the framed photograph on my desk and prop it up in front of you as you read. I don't want you thinking about the way I am now. I want you thinking about that 25-year-old lieutenant who is throwing his hat into the air on Victory Day. Listen, In Russia, after the war, there was a shortage of everything, including bread. There was, in fact, a famine in Russia after the war, and 2 more million died. There was also a shortage of men. Well, there was a shortage of women, too, and of children, and of old people. But the shortage of men was so extreme that Russia never recovered from it. The disparity today is 10 million. So it was a corruptingly good time to be male in Russia after the war, particularly if you were a handsome and wounded frontliner, as I was, returning to the great wail of gratitude and relief. And even more particularly if, as I was, you were corrupt already. My dealings with women, I concede, were ruthless and shameless and faithless and solipsistic to the point of malevolence. My behavior is perhaps easily explained. In the first 3 months of 1945, I raped my way across what would soon be East Germany. It would suit me very well if at this point I could Easternize your Western heart. Quote, the Russian soldiers were raping every German woman from 8 to 80, wrote one witness. It was an army of rapists. And yes, I marched with the rapist army. I could seek safety in numbers and lose myself in the peer group, for we do know, Venus, the key study is Police Battalion 101, that middle-aged German schoolteachers, almost without exception, chose to machine gun women and children all day rather than ask for reassignment and face the consequence. The consequence was not an official punishment, like being sent to the front, or even any mark of official disfavor. The consequence was a few days of peer displeasure before your transfer came through. The harsh words, all that jostling in the lunch queue. So you see, Venus, the peer group can make people do anything and do it day in and day out. In the rapist army, everybody raped. Even the colonels raped, and I raped too. There is a further mitigating circumstance, namely the Second World War, and 4 years on the dirtiest front of the dirtiest fight in history. Don't apply zero tolerance, a policy that calls for zero thought. I ask you not to turn your face away. I paid a price, as I said, and I have specific work ahead of me to pay it fully. So, Venus, I ask you to read on, merely noting for now the formation of a certain kind of masculine nature. A bashful and bookish youth finding his feet in the 1930s, a time of catastrophe and pan-terror, but also, if you please, a time of watchful prudishness from above. I lost my virginity to a Silesian housewife in a roadside ditch after a 10-minute chase. No, it was not the most auspicious of awakenings. I will add, in a pedagogic spirit, that the weaponization of the phallus in victory is an ancient fact, and one we saw remanifested on a vast scale in Europe in 1999. On my front in 1945, many, many women were murdered as well as raped. I can honestly say that this is beyond my understanding. I'm about to describe an unusually attractive young girl, and experience tells me that you won't like it because that's what you are too. I'm sure you think you've evolved out of it, out of invidiousness, but evolution is not the work of an afternoon. And in my experience, an attractive woman doesn't want to hear about some other attractive woman. It is the more problematic, perhaps, in that you will feel a protective pang for your mother, as is only right. So I invite you to put yourself in the place of one of Zoya's female contemporaries. She was 19, and from the outset, her reputation was frankly terrible. You will perk up at that. And yet the other girls took an exceptionalist view of Zoya. They instinctively indulged her as a vanguard figure, l'esprit fort. She lived more than they did, but she also suffered more than they did, and she showed them possibilities. It used to be said that Moscow was the biggest village in Russia. On the outskirts, in winter, there were little paths connecting each house with tram stops and food stores. Milk, said the sign, and everyone shuffled around like rustics in their short sheepskin coats, and you expected mammoths and icebergs. But that's a memory from childhood. No milk today. It changed, a primitive entanglement in which various foundries and blast furnaces and gasworks and tanneries had been planked down among the cottages and cobblestones. We had a village within the village, the district in the southeast known as the Elbow. And when Zoya walked into it in January 1946, she was like a rebuke to the prevailing conditions, the absence of food and fuel, the absence of books, clothes, glass, light bulbs, candles, matches, paper, rubber, toothpaste, string, salt, soap. No, more. She was like an act of civil disobedience. She was recklessly conspicuous, Zoya, and Jewish, a natural target for denunciation and arrest. Because that's how resentments and jealousies were resolved in my country for hundreds of years. That's how a love triangle could be wonderfully simplified. An anonymous phone call or an unsigned letter to the secret police. You kept expecting it, but there she was every day, not in camp or in prison, but on the street, with the same smile, the same walk. And I surprised myself, I, the heroic rapist, with the medals and the yellow badge. My first thought was not the first thought I was used to, some variant of when can I wrench her clothes off. No, it was this, and the sentence came to me unbidden and fully formed. How many poets are going to kill themselves because of you? Zoya was not an acquired taste. Her face was original, more Turkic than Jewish, the nose pointing down, not out. The mouth improbably broad whenever she laughed or wept. But her figure was a platitude, tall and ample and also wasp-waisted. Every male was condemned to receive its message. You felt it down the length of your spine. We all got it from the street draggletail who pleaded to carry her books and hold her hand, right the way up to our pale and ancient postman who, each morning, stopped and stared at her with his mouth unevenly agape and one eye shut, as if over a gun sight. Perhaps the single most unbelievably wonderful thing about her was that she had her own place, an attic the size of a parking bay, two flip floors up from her grandmother, but with its own stairs and its own front door. A 19-year-old girl in Moscow who had her own room. The equivalent, Venus in Chicago, would be a 19-year-old girl who had her own yacht. You would see her going in there at night with a man. You could see her coming out of there with a man in the morning. And there was something else. You won't believe this, but under the circumstances, I can't admit it. One of the more malarial rumors attached to her was that before each liaison, she went through some kind of Hasidic ablution that guarded her from pregnancy. This, then, was her preferred approach to the Jewish business of killing Christian babies. There were, of course, no contraceptives in Russia in 1946, and as your prospective lovers monotonously reminded you, the penalty for abortion, quite mild considering, was 2 years in jail. We know quite a lot about the consequences of rape for the raped. Understandably, little sleep has been lost over the consequences of rape for the rapist. The peculiar resonance of his post-coital tristesse, for example. No animal is ever sadder than the rapist. As for the longer-term effects, what they were for me, I now came to understand. This was the mental form they took. I couldn't see a woman whole, intact and entire. I couldn't even see their bodies whole. Now, Zoya wielded an outrageous allocation of physical gifts. It would be my style to atomize them, to do what Marvel did to the coy mistress. Even her breasts, remember, were to be considered separately. To carve her up on the marble slab, each bit pierced by a flag pin and bearing a price. That's the way my mind went at it. So to encapsulate Zoya, unlike all the others, I saw as indivisible. Being indivisible was her prime constituent. Each action involved the whole of her. When she walked, everything swayed. When she laughed, everything shook. When she sneezed, you felt that absolutely anything could happen. And when she talked, when she argued and opposed across a tabletop, she leaned into it and performed a sedentary belly dance of rebuttal. And naturally, I wondered what else she did like that with the whole of her. We were neighbors and also colleagues at the Tech, the Institute for Systems, where she studied in the Jewish stream. I was 25 and she was 19. And Lev, for Christ's sake, was still at school. She used to run a regular errand for her mother, old Esther, bringing a few edible odds and ends for the scrofulous rabbi who lay endlessly praying and dying in the basement beneath our flat. The only way to get there was through the ground floor and down the spiral staircase outside our kitchen. These iron steps were often sheathed in ice, and after a mishap or two, she reluctantly fell in with my soldierly insistence that I should lead her there by the hand. She was actually not at all steady on her feet, and she knew it. Much later, Lev would learn that she lacked certain spatial wirings, certain readinesses, because as a child, she had never learned how to crawl. At the door to the basement, she would always give me a smile of gratitude, and I always wondered what the force was, the force preventing me from throwing my arms around her, or even meeting her eye. But the force was there, and it was a strong force. "Call my name when you want to come back," I said, but she never did. From the look of her sometimes, I thought she scaled those steps on her hands and knees. Then one night, I heard her voice, lost and hoarse, calling my name. I went out and took her surprisingly warm hand in mine. "Jesus," I said at the top. I thought I was going to take a toss. She smiled greedily and said, "You'd have to be a bloody mountain goat to get up there." We laughed, and I was lost. Yes, Venus, at that point, my desperate fascination became fulminant love, and it came on me like an honor. I had all the troubadour symptoms, not eating, not sleeping, and sighing with every other breath. Do you remember Montague, the father, and in Romeo and Juliet? "Away from light steals home my heavy son." That's what I was, heavy, incredibly heavy. It is the heaviness you feel when, after an hour-long fight for your life in an anarchic sea, you come out of the surf, drop to the sand, and feel the massive pull of the center of the earth. Every morning I would wonder how the bed could bear my weight. I wrote poems, I walked out at night. I liked standing in the shadows across the street from her house, in the rain, in the sleet, or, this was best, in an electric storm. When the blind was up, you knew that you would still be there to watch her close it. I once saw a man leaning against the window frame, his armpits insolently singleted, his chin upraised. I was jealous and all that, but I was also sharply aroused. That's right. I could sulk and pine, but my obsession was dependably and gothically carnal. I further confess that, while not really believing it, I was much taken with the story about the prophylactic ablution. I was used to a certain pattern, half-clothed fumblings, messy, intercrural compromises, and snuffling aftermaths. And this would be happening on stairwells, in alleys and bomb sites, or on a carpet, or against the table, with an extended family heaped up on the other side of a locked door. Oral relief, lasting half a minute, was the sex act of choice and necessity. And I offer this final observation, very vulgar, but not entirely gratuitous, in a pedagogic spirit, because it shows that even in their most intimate dealings, the women, too, were worked on by socio-economic reality. In the post-war years, there were no non-swallowers in the Soviet Union. None. Absent that little flourish of enthusiasm, and the sexual atmosphere was one of coercion, my humorless insistence, their faltering submission. So in Zoya's turret, under its witchy candle snuffer apex, there awaited something more futuristic than female consent, or even female abandonment. I mean female lust. "Do you know what you look like when you're with her?" Lev said this, I thought, with dissimulated ill will, I had just declined his offer of a game of chess, with an abstracted, frivolity-imputing wave of the hand. So I readied myself. "I'll tell you what you look like," he said, "if you want." He was more advanced and much busier than I was at 17 in the matter of girls, and so were his friends. In addition, the shortage of housing was slightly eased by the shortage of people. There was just a little more space and air, though I was never sure how far Lev got in those secluded intervals with his various Adas and Olgas. The tempo of the age was speeding up, or was trying to. You can't see yourself in history, but that's where you are, in history. And after World War I, revolution, terror, famine, civil war, terror, famine, more terror, World War II, and more famine, there was a feeling that things could not but change. Universal dissatisfaction took the following form. Everyone, everywhere, complained about everything. We all sensed that reality would change, but the state sensed us sensing it, and reality would not change. All right, I said, what do I look like? What? He had a certain expression sometimes, Lev, that I knew, that I feared, a sharpened focus, an amusement with something savage in it. You look like Vronsky when he starts shadowing Anna, he said. Quote, like an intelligent dog that knows it's done wrong. Yes, I'm afraid so, he said, poking out his cigarette. And anyway, she's already got a boyfriend. I said, I know she has, and I'm waiting him out. Yep, that's it, he concluded with satisfaction, as if dusting his palms. That's what you look like. You look like a clever dog that knows it's about to be thrashed. My brother started smoking early. He started drinking early, too, and having girlfriends early. Increasingly, people do everything early in Russia because there isn't much time. He gets to be alone with Zoya in her conical attic. And he feels that he's going to have to ask her out because she's almost certainly about to be arrested. That day, the whole tech was talking about that day when they'd gone to a meeting at the Komsomol, the Communist Youth. And after the keynote address, you know, 2.5 hours long, entitled "The Scum of the Anarcho-Syndicalist Deviation and the City Administration Committee Decision About the Party Meeting at the Mining Institute," Zoya comes out of the meeting saying that the talk had bored her tits off. And no, you just couldn't say that. Doubly provocative, and she was trebly endangered. Boredom and breasts and Jewishness. That night, every time I heard a car or a truck in the street, I thought, it's them, they're here. Something strange was happening in the Soviet Union after the war against fascism. Fascism, by which I mean an abnormal emphasis on the folk, the great Russians, together with an abnormal xenophobia. Pogrom was coming. So there were sensible, indeed cynical, reasons for Zoya to look kindly on me. It was one thing to stage conspicuous entanglements with your fellow Bohemians, and especially your fellow Jews. It was another thing to be the devoted companion of a tall and handsome war hero with his medals and his yellow badge denoting a serious wound. Not much fun to say all that, but I'm telling you, my dear, this is the meaning, this is the daily and hourly import of state systems. He makes a kind of vague pass at her, and she allows him to kiss her, and she retains his lower lip between her teeth for a second, and then says, "You frighten me." And he stumbles off down the stairs and concludes. They didn't come for her, of course, they came for me. And understand that it didn't feel like the worst thing that had ever happened when, 10 weeks later, they gave me 10 years. Thank you very much. Thank you. That's very generous. Now some questions from...
Clearly Russia has interested you for a long while. You spoke of Dostoevsky's impression on you and Hausa and Pope of Dread. And this book now, I'm curious both personally and also as it speaks to your method of writing, why you've never ever gone.
Why am I so interested and yet have never gone? Once I got the feeling that this novel was coming, I had a chance to go to Russia, but I didn't take it because I wanted to, I thought it's too late now. I mean, if I'd been 5 years ago, it would have marinated, but I didn't want to come back with a lot of undigested sense impressions. You couldn't write about September the 11th on September the 12th. You can't write about anything until it's been in your system for perhaps 2 or 3 years at a minimum. And Norman Mailer said that there was a huge temptation for writers to charge in after September the 11th. He said this is to be resisted. Just now we're seeing several novels that address that day and the repercussions of that day, and it's more than a decent interval. It's the interval needed to get to allow it to trickle down into the unconscious, which is where fiction comes from, as opposed to essays and discursive thinking. So the same with Russia, and again I do think Dostoevsky described here as that old jailbird, windbag, and genius. And I'm rereading him now. He's incredibly crude, Dostoevsky. Genius is his only virtue. He's got no talent whatsoever. But my, how he appeals to scowling, nihilistic 17-year-olds in their rooms, in this sort of terrible pit of lassitude and disgust and meaninglessness. And that's why I think the young still like him, because he as if life isn't hard enough already, he all his characters invent pain and invent difficulty, and that's an adolescent feeling. And when I was writing this book, I sometimes occasionally think, that the motivation here is a bit thin, isn't it? And then I'd think, he's Russian, You've got to keep it slightly left field, slightly perverse. It's not the sort of cause and effect that you and I would recognize. Robert Conquest, a friend of my father's, author of The Great Terror, most famously, and The Harvest of Sorrow, which is about collectivization and the terror famine. And I think The Harvest of Sorrow is an even stranger book than The Great Terror. I think he did, because that came out when I was about 18 or 19, and I was only just beginning to read seriously then, and I didn't read it all, but I did look at it, and the kind of response to that was very important and interesting, and it was just the last phase. That book really killed off the remaining sympathy for the Soviet Union, which had just survived much unignorable evidence of how horribly travestied the Russian experiment had become. People think that it was only the intellectuals who were beguiled by the Soviet Union, thinking, like Orwell said, that an ordinary person is too stupid to fall for that kind of rubbish. It's only the intellectuals who have real prowess of wrongheadedness, that they really get it wrong. But it's not true, and elsewhere, Conquest has many fascinating pages on how businessmen, politicians, sociologists, and historians all fell for for this idea. And you know, to put it at its most poetic level, think of the absolutely marvelous description of Trotsky in Saul Bellow's Augie March, a passage full of, you know, tremendous feeling and beautifully done, and Bellow, as it happened, did see the dying Trotsky in Mexico. What incredible geo-historical coincidence. So all the best people passionately wanted this to work, and that's not an ignoble thing. You know, the real hunger for a system that was just a little bit better than anything that had come before, a little bit fairer, a little bit gentler. And of course, it turned out to be the opposite of that. And the reason I think that we were so slow to realize this is that an accurate description of the Soviet Union exactly coincided with an hysterical slander of the Soviet Union. It wasn't that the thing had gone a little bit wrong. It was as bad as it's possible to imagine. And one writer, Shevchenko, was it, describes a scene where mothers are queuing up at the jail where all their husbands and sons have all been arrested, and daughters, and they're wailing and pleading to be able to give a little parcel of food, and they're being turned away. And he said, you know, a great theatrical genius at the height of his powers couldn't come close to in staging anything half so terrifying as this.